Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Tired of spills and stains on your sofa? Wash away your worries with Anabe. Anabe is the only machine washable sofa inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly prices. That's right, sofas start at just $699. Enjoy a no-risk experience with pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and changeable slip covers made with performance fabric. Experience cloud-like comfort with high-resilience foam that's hypoallergenic and never needs fluffing. The sturdy steel frame ensures longevity, and the modular pieces can be rearranged anytime. Shop washablesofas.com for early Black Friday savings, up to 60% off site-wide, backed by a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not absolutely in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping or restocking fees. Every penny back. Upgrade now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Huge honor tonight to be interviewing Ori Spado out of California. Now, I've been watching some of his videos on YouTube, and he has a book out called The Accidental Gangster about his life from insurance to becoming a mob boss. Ori has mixed with some of the biggest names in the mafia community, and also he's rubbed shoulders with people who've killed dozens of other people. So we're going to be getting to the harder hitting stuff later on, but I'd just like to start out, Ori, asking, where was it you grew up in America, and where was your family descended from?
We're from Calabria, Italy. But I grew up in a small town upstate New York, Rome, New York. And from there, eventually New York City. And I lived in Florida, but I've been out here in Los Angeles for over 40 years.
As a kid, did you see the local gangsters? Did you think, like, what is this lifestyle these guys are living, to be wearing these flash clothes and having all this money? Or was it later on when you fell in with them?
It was later on that I actually saw it. After I did some research on my ancestry through my aunt and through a dear friend of mine, Frank Russo. Frank Russo's father was the boss in upstate New York. And on Saturday mornings, Frank Russo, who became a lawyer, used to open the cellar doors and let just a few guys go in for Saturday meeting. One of them was my grandfather. Our name back then was Spada, S-P-A-D-A. And Frank was well known throughout the country. He was a lawyer, but he still knew everybody. And he was the guy that everybody went to for favors. And I'm very close with his son, Drew Russo. And I keep kidding Drew. I said, it's all your father's fault. Because his father introduced me to Frank Costello, the Russell Buffalino, who Joe Pesci just played, and the Irishman, Carlo Marcello, and of course, Sonny Francese.
Do you want to explain to people, because I've got a lot of people in the UK watching this, and they may not be familiar with those names. Do you want to run down who those people are?
Well, Frank Costello was one of the original guys with Lucky Luciano and Meyer Lansky going way back. He was a gentleman. He ran Tammany Hall, ran the politics. Russell Buffalino was known as the Quiet Don from Pennsylvania and parts of upstate New York. And he was quite a guy. As you saw in the movie, Joe Pesci played him perfectly. And then Carlo Marcello was out of Louisiana, New Orleans. And he's one of the people, along with Santo Tripicana and other, that they say was responsible for the assassination of President Kennedy.
So they had the Mafia Council, the various families. Can you explain what that is and which family you're talking about?
Well, the family that the U.S. attorney has me with is the Colombo family. I always considered myself a renegade, but of course, U.S. attorneys think differently, as you well know. I was with the Colombo crime family, and with Sonny Frances, who we've been friends for over 40 years, and we still are to this day. Sonny's 102, and we talk about once every week or couple weeks. And I'll tell you, at 102, he's got all his mind there.
Yeah, I've watched him on YouTube, and I've watched his son's videos on YouTube as well. So we've jumped ahead a bit. You've mentioned some huge names in the old school mafia upper tier.
I'll tell you, one of the best guys that I ever met and became one of my best friends is Joey Pyle from London. Joey Pyle was my best mate. I can't say enough about him. I can't say enough about the boys in London. Today, Joey's son is like, he calls me his father. From the U.S., I call him my London son. We're still close. And I've known him for years. Roy Shaw, Dave Courtney. I met everybody over there in London.
Yeah, I've had Dave Courtney on the podcast here.
Yeah.
And I had operations in Arizona. I was trafficking in Arizona, ended up with a similar case to you. So that was at the time when Sammy the Bull Gravano was out there, when he was doing his thing.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I read that in your thing. You and I actually have similar background.
RICO cases.
We both got RICO cases, but you were in the financial business. I was in the insurance business and financial business. So we got that. And maybe it's our experience in those that made us good at what we became.
Salesmen. You said that you clicked up with these guys later in life. It wasn't a childhood thing. You weren't like seeing them and idolizing them. So no. what was your childhood like then? Were you stable?
My childhood, my father made $35 a week. Besides me, I had two brothers, three sisters. It was a humble, but my father was able to provide, and my mother was a great cook. We had a garden, and it was actually, pretty normal childhood upbringing.
And was it quite tough? Was your neighborhood quite tough? Did you say it was Rome, New York?
Rome, New York.
Was it tough though?
Was it what?
Was it tough in that neighborhood?
No, I got in a lot of fights. I was a guy that came through. I took care of a lot of things for other kids, things like that there. I was just a scruffer, and I fought. And then everybody I fought, we became best friends.
So what made you get interested in insurance?
Insurance seemed like it came to me so natural, I can't explain it. I was with a Prudential, and became a member of the Million Dollar Life Roundtable. It was quite an experience. I was making a lot of money. I was a young kid. I'm making freaking $500 a week. I'll never forget, there was an agent sitting next to me in the office. Fridays was payday, and I happened to glance over when he opened his check. And here's an older guy with a family, with children and all that there. I was still single, and his check's like $150. and mine's over 500.
What year was this?
That was 1960-something.
So that was a huge amount of
1968.
Money. 500's huge.
Yeah. And money just never stuck with me, though. I don't know why I always spend it.
What did you blow it on?
I had no idea. The hell I could tell you, but, you know, I spent money. I give money away. And I made a lot of money in my lifetime.
And what caused the crossover to associating with the mafia?
It just became a natural thing. And how it happened, it's really funny. It just came so naturally to me. The first time I met Sonny Frances, I remember meeting him with a Lou Perry, who was a casting director, the guy that discovered D. Martin Jerry Lewis, brought me to meet Sonny because a friend of mine's life was being threatened. And I met Sonny and I met his kids. They were all little kids at the time at Trattatoria Siciliana on 2nd Avenue. And we had dinner. And what's that thing that popped up?
You got some on your screen?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's on your screen. It's okay on this end. I can still see you fine.
And so where was I?
You went to dinner?
We went to dinner, and it was a dinner that they would never forget me, because Sonny and I sat there, we're whispering to each other, I explained it to him what the problem was with my friend, and he said that he would look into it, give back to me, and I gave him my number in Florida and my number to my office in upstate New York. Then we ate, and I ate a fish. I became allergic to it. And I was vomiting my guts out on 2nd Avenue and down in the toilet. It was bad. He had two guys, Johnny Irish and Red Crabby, bring me to the hospital. And I remember I'm waking up, and the doctor's asking these guys, what's his name? And the guy says, you don't need to know that, doctor. Just get him well. What's your name? Doc. Don't ask no question. Just get him well. And both those guys were drivers for Sonny at one time. And they're both dead now. Johnny Irish ended up dead in Florida.
So what was the first work you were putting in with your association?
Well, what happened was, at that meeting, Sonny did get a hold of me, and then we had a sit-down in New York, and it happened to be with his stepson, Michael Frances. And it didn't go that well for Michael. Michael was wrong in what he was doing. And Michael and I never got along since then. And Michael became an informant, as everybody knows. And now he's a born-again Christian, he proclaims. Do I believe that? No.
Well, at that meeting, you said what Michael was doing was wrong. What do you mean by that, at that meeting specifically?
Michael was having somebody robbing warranties. Name of the company was Polyglycol. No need to ever shine your car again. Guaranteed for 3 years. And Walter was just big. Every time you turn the TV, you see the ad. And he gave the distributorship for, it was Nassau, Suffolk County, Long Island, to his brother-in-law, who happened to also be Michael Frances' brother-in-law. And they were selling a inferior product, but claiming it was polyglycol. And they were stealing the warranties from the bottom out of Walter's office, from the bottom of the pile. Now, the only way Walter found out about it was they started getting claims on warranties that they never issued. And so Walter was going to take the distributorship, and Michael started calling Walter Fison and threatening his life. Walter commented, I said, Walter, nobody's going to call you and threaten your life. They're either going to kill you or they're not. I said, but people don't call up and say, I'm going to come and kill you. I said, you're not going to have a warning. So it's bullshit. And then Walter asked me to fly into New York. I was living in Florida in my condo there. And asked me to fly in to close Victor Potokin, who was the largest Cadillac dealer at that time. So we went, we closed them. We went to Club 21 for lunch. Walter went to make a phone call, comes back, white as a ghost, leans over, he says, kid, I know you're wired in. You got to stay and find out. And that's what happened. I did. I stayed. I found out. And as it turned out, it was Michael Franche. And so Sonny called us all. We had a meeting at the Russian Tea Room. And otherwise, after that, the only other time I saw Michael was, do you know anything about Michael Franche?
Yeah, I've watched most of his interviews on YouTube.
All right, Michael Franche, when he got out of prison, his brother was living out here. Asked his brother if I would meet him. And there used to be a place I hung out over on Santa Monica Boulevard called the Rangoon Racquet Club. I said, have him meet me there at 5 o'clock. I got there, Michael was there. I took him in the alley. He said, what do you need, Michael? He said, well, you know, he said, I said, no, you broke the mold, Michael. I said, but what do you want to see me for? He said, well, you know everything's going on here in town. I'd appreciate it if you could let me know if any strangers fly into town. I said, if your father asked me to do it, Michael, I'll do it. And he said, okay. And that's, he reached out to me. I never reached out to Michael for anything. I don't need Michael Franchese in my life. But, Sonny called me the following week. Sonny was in prison. I asked Sonny, he said, don't do a damn thing. So I didn't do nothing.
How come Sonny ended up in prison?
Sonny ended up in prison several times. Basically, it stems from he originally got 50 years on a robbery where other guys were bank robberies, and throughout the whole country, I guess it was. And he got 50 years on it, and supposedly had nothing to do with it. I believe he was actually set up because the guys tried to say they paid tribute to Sonny, and Sonny didn't even know these guys. And he was, it was a setup. He ended up getting 50 years, I think. Got out at 12, and he's become the most violated person. I mean, he violated his paper so many times, over 6 times, that just kept going back to prison. And then his last indictment was the indictment with the Colombo family, which I was on that indictment as well. And yeah, that was his last. He's so 102.
Going back to your life then, you've described how you met the Sonny and Michael. So what kind of work were you then putting in for the Colombos?
Nothing. I had my thing going out here in California. A lot of things I did are legitimate. What I did that was not legitimate, I kept to myself. I'm not going to go tell everybody what the hell I'm doing.
I hear you. What stuff can you talk about?
Huh?
What stuff can you talk about?
What do you want to talk about?
Oh, what work you were doing that was legitimate in Hollywood?
I was doing marijuana. I was flying marijuana for Arizona weed every couple of weeks, 500 pounds from Arizona into New York and distributing it. That was a good gig for a while.
What year was that?
Actually, I think that was in the 2000s, early 2000s.
Okay, so that was when we were active in Arizona. So you were getting the weed coming up from Mexico, and then...
I had a guy in Arizona. He had a home, took the weed. We had the pilot, great pilot, older guy, loaded his plane. It was good. And I had my driver from the city. I had different airports that we scoured in upstate New York. Plane would fly in, unload, out. And I had it brought to a location in Brooklyn. I'd have my guys lined up. You get 50 pounds, you get, depending on what line of credit I gave these guys. And I wasn't around that weed for longer than 5 minutes. I distributed it, went to my hotel in Warwick, and then in the evenings, they came with the money and paid me.
So they're calling you a Hollywood fixer. Exactly what does that mean?
Well, Hollywood fixer. I began with Dino De Laurentiis and Ralph Serpy, who I also met through Frank Russo. I met them at the filming of The Brinks Job in Boston. And so we became close. I'd come to California. And a lot of times there'd be a problem with the studio and agent, actors and actresses having a problem. And they called me. And I resolved the issues. It was like selling insurance. It was very easy to convince the people why they should do the right thing. It came as a second. I never needed a gun to do anything.
And could you give an example of the kind of communication involved in that?
Oh, well, there was one. There was an actor, a big actor that everybody would know, action guy, and agency owed him $2 million, and they would not release it because the producers, they were waiting for the producer, and the producers were having an issue because of something the actor didn't do. And having to be two producers, one who lived in Los Angeles, the other who lived in Vancouver. So I contacted the guy who lived in Los Angeles. He met me at the Four Seasons. We had a talk. He understood who he was talking to. We set up another meeting where his partner came in from Vancouver. We sat down, we ironed it out. They called the agency and had the money released. But unfortunately, that action star became an informant on another case in New York. And I never got a nickel. I never got a thank you from him.
Jeez. Someone who was more reliable paying you was Shug Knight. What was your relationship with him?
Shug was a good guy. There was a guy from London that Joy introduced me to because I had a stock of inventory from Universal, DVDs and DVDs, whatever they were in those days. And he wanted to buy them all. We agreed on a price, and Ron Winters was a master of telling you he wired the money. And he never wired it. And I'm waiting for like a fool. And he comes up, well, the Bank of London, and then it went to this bank, and, you know, it takes longer. I mean, finally I realized, all right, the guy was. And when he would fly into Los Angeles, he would stay at a hotel but never use his own name. So you couldn't find this fucker. And one day, a producer had a meeting with him at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel and told me that this guy, Ron Winters was his name, was flying in. He had a meeting. I said, okay, I said, once you come down, let me know what room number. I'll be at the bar. Well, as it turned out, when the producer got there, Shug Knight was there. Because it happened to be the guy that also had Death Row, had the distributorship to distribute Death Row in England. But Ron Winters was distributing Death Row all over Europe. And he owed a ton of money to Shook. So when this guy told me, he said, there's this crazy guy, this Ori, he's very serious. He's going to throw him out the window. Shook came down to the bar, and that's when we met. And he asked me not to do anything. And he says that we'll make money on something else, as other things. And one day Shook called me. I went over to his office, met with him, and he told me this guy owed him millions of dollars. So Joey and I made an agreement, Joey Pyle. We made an agreement with Shook that we'll collect the money for less commission than we normally would. Well, we wanted to do it every month, and we'll make sure this guy pays. We'll get up our own bookkeeper, put him in Ron's office. And Joey got the first $1 million, was wired to Shook. By that time, Shook was violated, I believe, and was in prison up north. But he called his lawyer, and 10%, next day, $100,000 was in my bank.
Wow.
Kept his word. And, of course, I took care of Joey in London. And we were all happy, but then I became close with the guys in his office, and we wanted for Joey Jr., who flew here, him and my son, to be on the visiting list so we can continue the deal with Shook. And they assured us that they were on the list. So Joe flew in, my son Anthony picked them up. They had to fly in someplace up north to rent a car. They get to the prison, they're not on the list. So we never got the opportunity to collect any more money, but, you know, Shook and I remained close. And, you know, we would run each other in the Four Seasons or other places. And even when I was away, he would run into my son and always send his love. So I got nothing bad to say about Shook Knight.
What do you think about the case he's in for now?
The case against him?
Yeah.
I think, I don't think he should have gotten all the time that he got. They were going to try to kill him. I firmly believe it was probably an accident. He didn't run over that guy and intentionally. That's my belief, and others believe the same thing. But then again, he's Shook Knight. He was notorious. And, you know, when the government wants you, they're going to get you, right or wrong. Most people don't understand how the system works. And in this country, they keep... My next book's going to be called My Journey Through the Judicial System. It's going to be quite a different book because I'm going to show people what the Bill of Rights says and what they really give us and my interpretation of the Constitution. You hear that every day if you turn on a TV today. They talk the constitutional right. What freaking rights do we have? I mean, I'm not allowed to smoke in this apartment. I pay my rent here. Government don't pay my rent. I pay it. But they passed a law now, you can't smoke in your own home. Now, is that a free country?
I never heard of that. In England, you can still smoke in your own home.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's Beverly Hills, California. Of course I smoke. I pay no attention to it. But if you get caught smoking out on this, you can walk with a cigarette. But if you're standing still, they'll give you a ticket.
They got to fill those prisons up somehow.
Well, they're doing a good job of it.
So if you were close to Shug then, do you have any theories about what happened to Tupac?
Tupac got killed, didn't he?
Yeah.
I really don't have a theory on it. I don't believe the only person that really knows what happened is the person that did it. Everything else is a theory. You know, you got to remember it was the East Coast, West Coast thing. And I believe it was all part of that war, the East Coast, West Coast. They claimed this guy, Orlando, what's his name? Got my name. Orlando Anderson is the shooter. So that might be, I guess, and that's all we can go about.
Because like you said about the government, he was speaking out about the government as well, wasn't he?
Dead too. Orlando Anderson's dead. So I don't believe it was probably Orlando Anderson. It was a good, clever hit.
So on another interview, what I found fascinating, somebody had threatened somebody, said they were going to kill them. And you said real gangsters don't pre-announce that they're going to kill you. You know guys who've murdered dozens of people, and they would never ever say that they'd done anything because of the statute of limitations. What makes a good hitman?
What makes a good hitman?
Yeah.
A good hitman has got to be able to do it properly, quietly, and dispose of the body. Disposing of the body is the most important thing. Because with no body, there's no crime. And it takes a work of art.
Tired of spills and stains on your sofa? Wash away your worries with Anabe. Anabe is the only machine washable sofa inside and out, where designer quality meets budget-friendly prices. That's right, sofas start at just $699. Enjoy a no-risk experience with pet-friendly, stain-resistant, and changeable slip covers made with performance fabric. Experience cloud-like comfort with high-resilience foam that's hypoallergenic and never needs fluffing. The sturdy steel frame ensures longevity, and the modular pieces can be rearranged anytime. Shop washablesofas.com for early Black Friday savings, up to 60% off site-wide, backed by a 30-day satisfaction guarantee. If you're not absolutely in love, send it back for a full refund. No return shipping or restocking fees. Every penny back. Upgrade now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
Yeah, I interviewed a guy who was an associate of the Bonanno crime family, and he worked under Charlie Bats Battaglia, and he said that the Bats had whacked people from coast to coast and buried the bodies, and he taught him all the methods of getting rid of the bodies, because he'd never got caught, like, you know, putting a dead dog, burying the corpse really deep and then putting a dead dog over it so that the cadaver dogs, if they come out, they smell the dead animal and they don't go any deeper and find the corpse and things like that. Anything you can share?
Well, I'll tell you, years ago, was, you know, here, you know, double bodies in a coffin. You know, you had guys, they were friends of ours, and they own funeral home, and they're burying John Doe, but in the same coffin is somebody else. Never going to find it.
Yeah, he said Joe Bonanno Sr. Yeah. invested in funeral homes, and they had double-decker coffins.
Yeah.
What do you think of Joe Bonanno Sr.? Because he was running the commission for a long time. He got run out of New York, but he actually died of natural causes. So you could say, being in that lifestyle, you know, he kind of got away with a lot and lived a long time.
Well, what do I personally think of Joe Bonanno? I think he messed up. And what most people don't realize, and I know a lot of Bonanno guys. I know the guy was just the former boss of the Bonanno. I was away with him in prison. He's a good guy. But, you know, Joe Bonanno is a guy who started bringing the heroin over. And that was a big mistake, I feel. Because drugs changed everything, and nothing today in the life is like it was in the old days, where those guys that, you know, you mentioned earlier with Russell Bufalino, Frank Costello, or the Sonny Franceses. And, you know, out here in California, there was a guy, and a lot of people never heard of him, but he was the underboss of Los Angeles, Jimmy Cacci. Jimmy was a great guy. He was one of my best friends out here. We did a lot of things together, Jimmy and I.
Don't you think that the power has shifted, though, to the people who did get involved in the drugs because that became the biggest profit opportunity for criminal organizations?
Well, you know, what happened is the bosses became too greedy, too stingy, keeping all the money, and the other guys aren't, you know, when your employees are not eating, you're forcing them to go do something else. And they're so happy that drugs, there's a lot of money in it. And there's a lot of time if you get caught. A lot of time. A lot of people facing life.
What's your thoughts on the Gambinos and Paul Castellano getting taken out by Gotti and the Bull and that crew?
You know, John Gotti was a tough guy. No question about it, he was a tough guy. I think it was wrong in the way he took out Paul Castellano. It was not approved by the other families. And the only one that ever attempted to do anything to remedy it was the Chin from the Genovese family.
Could you just explain a bit about the Chin, who he was and what he was notorious for?
Chin, he was the boss of the Genovese family. And he's also the guy that shot Frank Costello, but never killed him. Just grazed him in Frank's building. And he's the guy that walked around the neighborhood in his bathrobe, acted like he was crazy. And it's a true story. The FBI came one day and looking for him, and his wife let him in the house, and he was in the shower with an umbrella. But you know, he got away with that for a long time. It really actually worked. But he was a good boss. He was a good boss, and the Genovese family, good earner, even to this day.
So you said the Chin retaliated against Gotti's crew.
He tried to have John, I think his car bombed, I think it was. I can't remember right now. But he did, and it didn't work. And then John got the guys who did it. But, you know, they both ended up dying in jail. John died of cancer, throat cancer. Guy never smoked. So you go figure.
And then they all got arrested, and you saw the fallout then with Gotti and Sammy the Bull. So Sammy the Bull, he recently did an interview on YouTube, gave his side of the story. He said that John was hanging him out to dry and he had no choice. And Gotti's family, of course, they're saying that Sammy's a rat. And he sold them all out. Which side do you, if any, go on?
Well, I think it was wrong for John in a manner of talking about Sammy. And then there's Sammy. They're all there, him, LoCascio, all charged with the same crimes and everything. And instead of sticking together and fight it, they made a decision to try to hang it on one guy who happened to be Sammy. So Sammy was an earner, and Sammy was a real guy, did work. He was there for John for anything. So for me to say something and get involved in some other family's business, it's not my right. And I don't, you know, but one thing I'll say about each and every one of them, they were all men. And there was a rumor somebody started saying that John Gotti was punked in prison. That's total bullshit. I was in prison. I wasn't John Gotti. And I can guarantee you, I was well respected every place I was at. And that's how they treated all the Italian guys, like myself, with respect.
What made Sammy the Bull such a good underboss? What made Sammy the Bull such a good underboss?
Nowadays, well, in those days, Sammy actually did the work himself, or primarily most of the work Sammy did, he had others do it. But he had done work on his own, no question. But he was a hell of an earner, making a lot of money. Tons of money for the family. And nowadays, that's it. You don't have to do the work today. Today is earn money for the family. And, you know, that Michael Franchese, he made a ton of money. And he's got between $50 and $100 million put away. And I don't know where it is today, but I know initially it went to Panama because I know the lawyer who made that arrangement. And he never paid the government or anybody. So there's all sorts of games, and games are played every single day in the life. And it's like a dear friend told me in prison, and this guy became the boss of the Bonanno family. When he was getting transferred out of Brooklyn, he says, Ori, when you get out, get back to California. Don't freaking talk to nobody. You got a good life out there. Forget about these people here. He says, everybody's a freaking rat. And he's true. He's correct. I mean, there are so many informers on the streets and benchifers that they're taping each other.
There's more informers than police now in America.
Right. And, you know, years ago, the FBI and the LAPD, OIC, used to follow me around. They don't have to leave their offices. They know what you're doing today. They don't have to follow you around. I used to have to dodge them. I mean, I know they follow me, and they used to like to follow me because I eat in the best restaurant. But, I mean, it got to the point I pull up. I give my car to the valet. I know there are a couple cars behind me. I walk in the front door. I walk out the back door, had somebody wait, and I'm gone. And they're in the restaurant, and they can't find me. I mean, those were some of the things that I had to do just to, and I was a free man. But
you mentioned being well-respected in the prison system. How much time did you do? Was it state or federal?
Federal time. I did 60 months.
Did you get SWAT team raided, or did you just have to turn yourself in?
No. You think they ever allow any of us to turn ourselves in? I haven't seen it happen. I knew the day was going to come because Sonny called me in New York when his son, Johnny, went missing. I was one of the last guys talking to Johnny. Johnny was working at a rehab home down in off Washington in West LA. And Sonny asked me he was going to buy a car from somebody in the program. And Johnny called me. He got to pick it up from Glendale. I'll bring it to you, Uncle Laura. I'll be there tonight. And at nighttime, he calls me. He said, look, the guy don't have it ready. I got to stay overnight. I'll see you first thing in the morning. Next morning, I'm calling, no answer. His mother's calling, no answer. Sonny's calling. Me, Sonny, and the wife are on the phone. And all of a sudden, You can't leave no messages on Johnny's phone. Johnny just disappeared. So after a while, Sonny asked me to come into New York, and we had a meeting at my hotel. And when I flew into New York, Sonny always stayed with me at the Warwick. I always had a suite, and always had a place for Sonny. Always stayed with me. Because him and his wife, although they loved each other, just didn't get along. And she constantly throwing them out. But we had a few guys over. We discussed the disappearance of Johnny. And, you know, they say that might have been the time and place where Sonny put a hit out on his son, Johnny. I can't confirm that nor deny it. But I was leaving the next day. Sonny's driver came, picked Sonny up. I was flying back to Los Angeles. My driver takes me to Kennedy Airport. I check in. I always got to stop. I go up to the gate, and then I'll always sneak in the men's room and have a cigarette before my flight. When I walk out of the men's room, there's two young kids. I call them kids. They were young guys. They go, Ori. And my first impression is that when I look at these guys, maybe they're on the same flight and they were friends of my son that I didn't recognize. And I go, yeah, FBI. I said, well, we'd like to have a word with you. And they take me to the side. They said, look, you could stop looking for Johnny. Johnny's with us.
Oh.
So now I know where Johnny is. I said, I'm going to call their parents, Johnny's parents, and let them know. We prefer you not to. I said, that's his parents. No matter where he's at, they got a right to know. And they said, look, we're going to give you, this is your last chance. You come to work with us. You could join us too. Otherwise, this is going to be your last flight on a real airline. And guess what? They were correct, because my next flight was on Con Air back to New York. So, and Johnny did testify at the trial against me, his father, and everybody else.
Which jail did they book you into?
I was in a Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn.
Is that, it's called the MCC these days?
No, that's, and MCC is the Metropolitan Correction Center. That's okay. On Pearl Street in Manhattan.
So what?
MCC is in Brooklyn.
Gotcha. What year were you booked?
What are you saying?
What year were you arrested?
2006.
So what was it like going into the jail in that year?
What?
What was the jail like in that year? What was it like going in?
You know, it's something that I knew eventually was going to happen, but you hope it don't. I never dreamed that I would be brought in with all the Italians on a Colombo racketeering case. Because I'm a resident of Los Angeles, California. Have been for 40 years. And, you know, when they arrested me and they came to my home, they had me in the cuffs. They said, why are you arresting me? They had distribution of cocaine. I laughed at them and I said, I'll be out by dinner time. And I was. 62 months later. I know, but, and I still did not know it was a RICO. And they brought me downtown Los Angeles. That's where they booked me. And then I remembered when the FBI, they took me in, they had like 23, 27 agents surrounding my building just to take one guy. I was 63 at the time. And when my attorney came, when I had to go for a hearing, his face was white. And he always told me, my attorney with Danny Bruckman, great guy here in Los Angeles, he always said that if I got caught up in one of those cases, he wouldn't know how to represent me and couldn't. And he came, he's got this freaking indictment about this thing, and he's white as a ghost, and I see my son and my bail bondsman waiting for me. And then he shows me an indictment, and I see all these other names. Some of the names I did not even know. But there it was, a RICO indictment. And then, of course, the FBI said that there was a warrant out for my arrest, a bench warrant. There was none. So I couldn't get bail in Los Angeles. And my attorney got pissed. He said, Danny took care of everything. If I threw a cigarette out the window, which I did once, and I got a ticket for it. He took care of it. A warrant. Where'd this warrant come from? No warrant. So I said, all right, extradite me. And it's just a mindset. Once I got in prison, boom, okay, that's what it is. You know, it's not nice, but, you know, I'm going to get out. And then when I seen all the other charges, I didn't know the seriousness of them. But I was facing life in prison, with especially with that cocaine charge. I mean, it was 50 kilos or more.
Wow.
It was a bullshit thing. Never took place. All instigated by an informant. But it becomes an indictment. It was never going to happen. But, and I got the back to Brooklyn my first time in court. U.S. attorney gets up. We'd like to apologize to the courts and to Mr. Spado, because Mr. Spado does not have a bench warrant out for him. They mistaken him for somebody else. Yeah.
The games they play.
The games they play, nobody could really understand it. Nobody understand it.
Unless you've been in the system.
Unless you've been through the system. And now I couldn't get bail. I was denied bail 4 times, saying I'm a violent person. I got friends in England. I could flee the country. God damn it, man. I mean, you know. And my peers are not in Brooklyn, New York. My peers are here in Los Angeles. But they don't care. It don't make a difference. Because what they say the constitutional rights are, they don't pertain to you once they arrest you. Forget it. Throw them out the window. You got no rights.
Exactly. My bail was $750,000 cash only. So my lawyer comes in, asks for a bail reduction hearing. We get it. We get the hearing. Prosecutor sabotages it. Judge doubled the bail to $1.5 million cash only.
Yeah. So you never got out.
Never got out. I was in Sheriff Joe Arpaio's jail for 26 months fighting the case. Now, in that jail, it's just gang and drug infested mayhem.
You were in state?
State, yeah, state. How would it, was the prison population divided where you were housed?
In Brooklyn, you know, we had our tent, we had our table. The Jamaicans had theirs, Dominicans. That was back in Brooklyn. And once they, after 30 months, it took over 30 months before, you know, my case, I got sentenced, and they shipped me to Lompoc, which they call low security. It's really a medium. But I didn't really care for Lompoc, but there is, they were originally going to try to, they were trying to make that for all pedophiles. And then the government changes, the Bureau of Prison changes its mind. So you had a lot of pedophiles there. They kept to themselves. And then being out here on the West Coast and didn't have no Dominicans, you had the Mexicans. And the Mexicans were a big group. And a tough group and a good group. And, you know, It wasn't bad. I can't say that it was really bad. The weather was cold up there. You know, I thought I was going to be at Terminal Island. I'm still going to be able to conduct business. No, that didn't happen for me.
Yeah, up until a month ago, I lived with a guy in the UK here, one of my former trafficking associates out of England who lived in Los Angeles. And he ended up in Lone Park, but it was before you. He was in Lone Park in the late 1990s.
Yeah.
For his trafficking case. So what made you want to write a book?
I've been an avid reader all my life. Ever since I was a kid, I still read every day. I thought I read a lot of books in prison, but now I see that you beat me by quite a bit. I read over 300 books. And how I... Reading books, you know, and you're walking the yard, you got a lot of time to think. And reading books, I always try to put myself in the position. And that's when I came up with the name The Accidental Gangster. And walking in, around prison, still never thinking that I would write a book. And once I got released, I had dinner with my my entertainment attorney and a dear friend, George Ham. And he says, Ori, write a book. I know your story, and then we'll do a movie. He said, find a writer. I couldn't find a writer. All I know out here are script writers. And so I sat down and I started typing. And I just began from when I was born. And actually, I began in prison, then thinking back. That's how I did it. You know, how the fuck did I end up here? Then... I found my co-writer, who happened to be somebody that we went to school together. And he was writing gangster books out of Las Vegas at the time, Dennis Griffin. But we teamed up, and thus we had the book, The Accidental Gangster. I'm very happy with the way it came. Wild Blue Press is our publisher. And the book is doing well.
It's got 4.7 rating on Amazon USA right now, which is extremely high. And anyone watching this video can just click below this video to the description box. And there's a link right there that will take you directly to The Accidental Gangster. If you want to buy the book, it's right down there. So please support Ori, you know, go down there and check the book out. You mentioned earlier that you were respected in prison. And we've all seen, I think it was, I don't know if it was Goodfellas or Casino, where it shows the Italian guys in there in the kitchen cooking up the chow. How is prison for the Italians?
I'm going to tell you something. In Brooklyn, because you have a lot of Italians from all the families. And come Christmas time, Thanksgiving time, these guys cooked. You couldn't get the free, you couldn't buy a better meal anyplace. All right? And they bake pies, and you wonder, how the freak did this happen? I mean, you know, and we always shared with other people, you know, the Jamaican, the black. You know, we always shared our food. That's just an Italian, which something we naturally do. When I got to Lompoc, there was actually only one other Italian guy there. And he was doing two lifetimes. His name was Iggy, and he and I became friends. And we walked the yard together. He was a great cook. And he would cook pasta for me once in a while. And then there were a few other guys up there that they'd get together and they did some special things for me. Otherwise, I ate tuna fish for 5 years.
If you could get your hands on what you really wanted to eat in prison, what would be your favorite prison food recipes?
You know, one of my favorite food growing up was the gnocchis. And there were two guys, they had a chef, I forget where he was from, but they surprised me on my birthday, and they made me gnocchis. And I remember, my birthday is December 17th, which is last week. It was colder than hell up there in Lompoc. But we sat out there, and I ate my gnocchis. They did a great job.
What are gnocchis?
Gnocchis are, I'm sure that you've seen them, and you've probably had them, like little potato dolls.
Okay, yeah, I've seen those. Yeah.
When my mother made them, she would, you know, she'd roll out the dough, and she, I mean, we call them sinkers. But it was always one of my favorite, yeah.
So did you have a lot of different cellmates over the years?
In Brooklyn, my best friend in Brooklyn was Charlie Carniglia, Gambino guy. And what they say, without Charlie Carniglia, there was no John Gotti. And Charlie ended up getting life plus 40. But Charlie was an expert at disposing of bodies. And, but he and I became best friends in Brooklyn. As far as cellmates, you know, there was always coming and going. Brooklyn is a place where they're coming and going. And I can't remember a lot of my cellmates, to be honest. I remember one that, you know, just before we locked down, they brought this new guy in to me. And I would always tell him the rules, how I clean the place, it's got to be kept clean, this and that. You know, because you got your own toilet, your own sink, your locker, and I give him the instruction. And then I would tell him, no, I don't know what you were in here for. I don't care what you're in here for. But if you're an informant, when they unlock these doors, I don't want to see you coming back in. I said, you understand that? And there used to be a place, they were all like born-again Christian. They had a little room that was on the first tier. And when they opened the doors, I seen him right there. And all these born-again Christians, they stuck together. They were all informants still. Like Sonny Frank Shays once told me, I remember it was on Father's Day. He said, show me a born-again Christian, I'll show you an informant. Yeah. And damn it, he was right. All right. And when they locked us up, that kid was no longer with me.
You said you were well-respected in prison, but there's always some numbskull that's going to start some shit. Did anyone try and start some shit with you?
I had one guy, you got to remember something. When they brought me to Lompoc, and we got off the bus from Victorville, we're chained, shackled, you know the routine, and they bring us through this area, and there's big glass, bulletproof windows, one guard back there, and everybody's got to get their name and number. I'm the last guy. Everybody gives their name, their inmate number. He gets to me, and the guard goes, now I want you all to look at that guy in the back. That's Ori Spato. He's the mob boss of Hollywood from the Colombo crime family. I swear to God. I sat there.
Time for a sofa upgrade? Introducing Anabe Sofas, where designer style meets budget-friendly prices. Every Anabe sofa is modular, allowing you to rearrange your space effortlessly. Perfect for both small and large spaces, Anabe is the only machine-washable sofa inside and out. Say goodbye to stains and messes with liquid and stain-resistant fabrics that make cleaning easy. Liquid simply slide right off. Designed for custom comfort, our high-resilience foam lets you choose between a sink and feel or a supportive memory foam blend. Plus, our pet-friendly, stain-resistant fabrics ensure your sofa stays beautiful for years. Don't compromise quality for price. Visit washablesofas.com to upgrade your living space today. Sofas start at just $699 with no-risk returns and a 30-day money-back guarantee. Get early access to Black Friday now. The biggest sale of the year can save you up to 60% off, plus free shipping and free returns. Shop now at washablesofas.com. Offers are subject to change and certain restrictions may apply.
What the fuck is it? A TV show? Then they bring you through the R&D. And you got to fill out these questions. You get your bedding, you get your clothing. And then they, you know, they're always going back to that holding cell. And this little guy comes, Spado, psst, psst, Spado, psst. Yeah, what's the problem? You answered this question wrong. Come with me. I said, what question is that? He says, this question, are you a member of organized crime, a gang, this and that? He said, you mark no. I said, yeah, that's correct. No, you're a member of the Colombo crime family. You're a member of the mafia. I said, where the fuck you get off with this shit, mafia? I said, it's made up by the prosecutors and the press. That answer is no. And it remained no.
Did the guards start any shit with you? Any guards over the years?
My first guard was actually, his name was Magana. And when I was putting in my list, my telephone list to get approved, I gave him a big list. And he got pissed and called me into his office. He said, don't you expect me to just take care of you? I said, look, it's our right. These are people who want to call. You got to do what you got to do to approve them. And then he changed the subject. He said, you know, I used to be a guard when Carmen Persico was here. So he starts telling me how, you know, Carmen had his own garden up there at Lompoc and so forth. And he asked me if I know Carmen. I said, I've heard of him. And he said, you only heard of him? But you're a Colombo. I said, yeah, but I heard of him. I said, maybe I read his name in the paper. But he started teaching me with respect. I had one issue. Because the guy happened to bunk next to some biker friends of mine. And my biker friends overheard this guy say that they wanted to do the same thing to me they did to John Gotti. Well, I heard about it, and the guy, he was on the upper bunk. So when the lights went out and everybody was asleep, I found my way to his bunk in the dark. And I put something to his corduroy to wake him up. I says, do you want to do something to me? I says, you do something to me, you're never going to fucking wake up again. You see how I'm here now? I said, are we going to have a problem? No, sir. Never had a problem. That was the only thing that ever happened.
Did you ever get any disciplinary tickets?
Discipline, no.
And did you have many people visiting you?
No. You got to remember, I was born in upstate New York, so my family's upstate New York. I didn't want nobody visiting me. My two sons visited me one time in Brooklyn. I mean, my son lived in Florida, my other son in California. So, you know, then I had things arranged because I thought I was going to be sent to Terminal Island, which is only 45 minutes away from here. Instead, and even the judge asked for me to be sent to Terminal Island. But BOP didn't do that. I think the FBI fixed it. Sent me as far away as possible. I didn't want a lot of people visiting me. My son, he came a few times with his girlfriend. I had a few other people come visit me. One guy from London came and visited me, Joey Pyle's brother.
Are you allowed in England now, or because of your record, won't they let you in?
I can't see them not allowing me in. My passport was never taken away from me because I never got bail. I have a passport. I often wonder if I'm going to get stopped if I fly there.
Because we interviewed John Elite Gambino from in London. He was in London. And Francis, he's been out here. But other people, they've stopped. They wouldn't let Mike Tyson in. But I guess because he's such a big name, you know, they knew all of his criminal history.
Well, you see the two names that you mentioned that they allowed in? They're both informants. I know Michael Francis tried to get in touch with my friends when he did come there. My friends, you know, I gave you their name. You know who they are. They told him they didn't even want him in fucking England.
Did you come across any high-profile prisoners?
Yeah. One guy, they call him Lollipop. A Colombian big guy, heavyweight. Actually, he just gave him, he was an informant on El Chapo Guzman. Now, here's a story. This is something else that most people will not think I'm, they'll think I'm bullshitting. This guy got arrested while he was getting plastic surgery in South America. Got arrested, bro. His face was all scarred. And he's on the bus. We're going to court. And when he got on the bus, me and my co-defendants, we always hung together. But when he got on the bus, he was able to recognize you were somebody. He goes like this to me. I go like that. He had a few billion dollars. Billions. Guy was big. I know who his lawyer was. I saw him with his lawyer. His lawyer had paralegals that were broads. Gorgeous. Now, me and my co-defendant, we're going down. You get to use the visiting rooms in the morning to listen to your discovery. And he'd be there, he's in a room. What they're doing, I don't know, but every day. And what happened was, this guy, and they had him on a murder charge in Brooklyn. You know, he was a big cartel guy. I could look up his freaking name, but if you look up Lollipop Drug Dealer, you'll find him.
I'll just have a quick Google of that now. Lollipop Drug Dealer. Colombian, did you say?
Yeah.
Colombia. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Juan Carlos Ramirez Abadia alias Chupeta.
That's it.
Born February 1663, Palmira, Colombia. Drug trafficker until his capture. One of the leaders of the Norte, that's the North Valley cartel, because I've written a book about the Cali cartel. So these guys were rivaling the Cali cartel after Pablo Escobar's dominance. Yeah, big time. Definitely big time, this guy. Like you say, worth billions. Man, that's a crazy story right there.
Let me tell you what happened. If you get into the part you study about it, after his sentencing, he disappeared. Now, he arranged, he gave a couple families, a couple guys in Colombia, $1 million or $2 million each, put some cocaine on a boat, and then he informed on them. So now that makes him eligible for the Witness Protection Program. Those guys, a couple $1 million each for their family, and they get 10 years each, ain't no big deal to them. After this guy's sentence, he disappeared. He's not in prison. I talked to an investigator. I'm telling a reporter, a dear friend of mine in New York about it. I tell him who his lawyer was. He says, I'm good friends with him. I called the lawyer. Lawyer said, I don't know who you're talking about. Bullshit, he don't know. He went to Columbia a couple of times. I know this. I seen it. Guy was on the witness, but how much of his $2 billion he had to give our government? And people don't realize the guys who got that kind of money, they could buy their way out of prison. And that's exactly what he did. And they brought this guy back, you'll see, where he informed against El Chapo Guzman. Brought him back into court.
So these guys, they make the billions, but does that money then end up in the hands of the authorities anyway?
And it's Department of Justice. Yeah.
So basically, Chapo, Escobar, they're like fall guys, really, in the war on drugs. The money ends up going back to the government.
Right.
The house always wins.
Huh?
The house always wins, like in the casino.
That guy, Lollipop, he got a hell of a deal. He's out of prison.
Would you say that the rise of the Mexican cartels and the Colombians has reduced the power of the Italian mafia?
I don't think the Italian mafia has the power or will ever have as much power as they used to. Not in this country. because law enforcement has just become so heavily. At the time of my arrest, the FBI had agents attached to all the five families. They since reduced that there, and they got like two squads for the whole five families. And if you notice, at the time that we got busted with the Colombo, they had a massive Gambino bus, all the families. I mean, we were all in prison. And, you know, there hasn't been much after that there.
The Bonanno associate that I interviewed, he was active in the 1960s. And he said back then, the old school code was, you know, you don't harm women, don't harm kids. But now the new cartels have come in. They'll kill your entire family. They'll torture them. They'll video it. They'll put it online.
That's the cartels.
Yeah. So is that where organized crime is at these days? Have all the old school values gone?
Well, honestly, you know, like my friend Joe said to me when he left, I took his advice. All right, I came back here because I actually had two informants, Johnny Frances and Gaetano Fittaro, Guy Fittaro, who came out here. And we went to the Ivy over on Robertson Boulevard. And I'm sitting between the two of them, and they both had tape recorders going. So, knowing how easy it is, you can't talk to nobody today. You don't know. And don't think that they're wearing a wire on their chest. That ain't the case. And both armistices, it was in their watch. They could put it in your eyeglasses. They could put it in, what do you call those things? I mean, the equipment they got, we had 3,500 hours. Nobody had a wire. Search all you want. Not going to find a wire.
So how realistic was the Irishman?
Frank Sheeran did not kill Jimmy Hoffa. And he also proclaimed that he killed Joey Gallo. Never happened. I thought the movie was too long. I thought Joe Pesci did a fantastic job. Jim Pacino did an excellent job playing Jimmy Hoffa. Played it pretty well. Uh, What am I to say? It's a $179 million bill. And I forgot how many hundreds of millions it has been, whatever it is, has seen it on Netflix. You know, you got to remember, no studio would touch it. It got to Paramount. They wanted to do it. Their executives would not approve the financial budget on that there. But it was Paramount, I believe, who brought it with Martin Scorsese to Netflix. And thank God, I watched it on Thanksgiving Day at my home right here. And I watched it in four segments. I cut it up. Because if I had to go to the movie theater and watch a film for 3.5 hours, I guarantee I would have walked out.
What's your theory on who killed Hoffa?
My theory on who killed Jimmy Hoffa? I can't tell you who killed Jimmy Hoffa. I'm going to think it was Tony DePro, no question about that there. Okay? Tony Provenzano. One thing that they did do, Martin Scorsese did, they showed him being cremated. You know, that's one theory that I never read about that might have happened to him. That's a good possibility, isn't it?
Yeah.
I heard that he went through a meat grinder, hamburger grinder. That's what I heard.
What did you hear about JFK?
JFK? There again, it'd be my conspiracy theory. Everybody's heard of the underworld. Nobody's heard of the overworld. Many, many years ago, a guy came to me and he had papers from the overworld. The overworld was Aristotle, Onassis, and that type of thing. The underworld, of course, being guys like me. And I know Ted Kennedy went to Aristotle, Onassis, and said he wanted to run for president. And Ari told him, you run for president, same thing happened to your brother is going to happen to you. Ted never ran. John Kennedy was could have been a great president. And, he did it, I think it was a big mistake, making his brother the attorney general and then have him go against the same people that put him in the office. That was no good. That was rotten shit. He got shot too. A lot of people are not like me, but you don't do that. He wanted to play his own political game. It's like he didn't care for his brother. I blame Robert Kennedy for killing John Kennedy. How was that one?
In more recent years, we had the Chomo, Jeffrey Epstein got taken out or suicided in your state. Did you hear anything on that?
I don't believe he committed suicide, I'll tell you that much. When you're dealing with that kind of money, that kind of power of the people that were around, you're talking about presidents. You're talking about leaders of countries.
Prince Andrew over here, he's been in the news a lot.
Over in your country there. What do you think is going to happen? You know, people used to come to me and had deals where we're going to make billions of dollars. And I said, you really think that's going to happen, huh? You ain't going to make it. You're going to get killed. Because those people are not going to allow it to happen. They say that if the wealth of this country was distributed equally, amongst every citizen in the United States. If everybody woke up tomorrow morning and had the same amount of money, in 6 months, 6 months, not 6 years, 6 months, it'd be back in the hands of the people who have it.
So you mentioned there's an underworld with people like you and an overworld. So you're saying the overworld took Epstein out.
The guy brought the papers to me, and it showed two guys at the grassy knoll in Dallas. Jimmy Fratiano and Johnny Roselli. They were at the knoll. The guy had shown me pictures. I never hear about them there. Did Lee Harvey Oswald really kill? You know, there's so many theories that they come out with. Who does really know? CIA know.
And do those guys, do they work with the underworld and get the underworld to do their hits?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When the FBI, CIA, DEA, when they need you, they'll come to you. They'll come to us. They might need somebody whacked. They did it in Mississippi with a Colombo guy. What the hell was his name? He worked as an informant. And he got more information from the FBI than he was Del Vecchio. What was his name now? I'm having a senior moment. But the FBI took him down, and he did the job down in Mississippi to find out who killed those young kids. It was an Italian that did that. So, you know, if they got a use for you, they're going to use you. If not, they're going to abuse you.
So with Epstein, then, do you think it's more likely they would have used the guards to do it if he was killed? They would have used the prisoners to do it? Or they would have sent someone into the MCC?
They could have done it either one of them ways. I'm going to imagine with the guards.
Because the guards are saying they both fell asleep simultaneously, which has never happened in the history of that jail since 1975.
Right. Were you in that? No, you were in state prison.
Arizona State.
You were in Arizona State.
Sheriff Joe Arpaio.
Joe Arpaio, that asshole. Yeah. Don't pardon him.
What's it going to take to get your story to the movie level then?
Well, we hope that happens. That's the dream of every one of us. I do have a couple of writers giving a stab at a script. I have Nick Pileggi, who did Goodfellas and Casino. He'll come aboard as an executive producer. Unless you want to come up with $250,000, he'll write the script. I got two writers writing on it. I think I got a good chance for a TV series. It's my theory, my feeling that it happens, then it's meant to be. If not, it's not meant to be. You know, but I got a little better advantage than a lot of people because I got a couple of agents in town. Once Nick approves the script, then I know I got a strong script, and then the agents will go out and sell it.
I think it's going to be phenomenal, and I'm going to read your book, and I'm going to probably have a lot more questions for you. People watching this video, you can click down there, and you can find a link on Amazon USA, a link on Amazon UK for Ori's book. You've been very generous with your time. Is there anything you would like to say?
Also go to www.theaccidentalgangster.com.
Rather than Jeff Bezos make all the money.
Huh?
Rather than Jeff Bezos makes all the money, the Amazon guy.
Yeah.
Is there anything you would like to say in conclusion to the people watching this video? A lot of young people.
A few things that I still have here. Yep. You know, you that? Charlie Bronson.
Charlie Bronson. Wow.
Charlie Bronson. We have other photos that Charlie used to send me different things. And this is a picture of my mate, Joey Pyle.
Wow.
I wish Joey were alive. But yeah.
A lot of young people watch my videos, and some of them have got gangsteritis. What do you say to those young people with gangsteritis?
With gangster what?
Gangsteritis. They want to be gangsters.
My suggestion is go to school, get a trade. Otherwise, you're going to end up dead or in jail. Those are the only options you got. It's not as glamorous. Would I do my life over again? More than likely I would. But I do not recommend it for anybody. I never involve my children in the life. And it's like I say in my book, if I could help one person from avoiding the life, then the book was well worth it then. No. The fast money, the fast woman, and the fast cars, I do you nothing when you're in prison. And you could attest to that.
I think that's a real good positive note to end it on, Ori. And I want to just really thank you for your time today. And wish you all the best.
It was a pleasure meeting you.
And I'll say hello to Dave Courtney and the fellas in London for you as well.
Thank you.
All right, you take care. Thank you.
Take care now.
Cheers.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. Social casino.
Owning a home is full of surprises. Some wonderful, some not so much. And when something breaks, it can feel like the whole day unravels. That's why HomeServe exists. For as little as $4.99 a month, you'll always have someone to call. A trusted professional ready to help, bringing peace of mind to 4.5 million homeowners nationwide. For plans starting at just $4.99 a month, go to HomeServe.com. That's HomeServe.com. Not available everywhere. Most plans range between $4.99 to $11.99 a month your first year. Terms apply on covered repairs.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right.